ready? Whoop, 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 whoop. Thank you to all those tools we used to use. Pour one out, let's talk about our favorite older tools. Throwbacks got us on track, let's give them some praise. So here we are talking about them on Tools Day. Welcome to Tools Day, a podcast about tech tools, tips, and tricks, every other Tuesday at 2. I'm your co-host, Yuna.
And I'm Chris.
And today we're talking about throwbacks, I guess.
How do I join it on this one?
Well, we were going to call the show Pour One Out to talk about all of our favorite tools that taught us a lot or we used to use, but maybe workflows have changed or like technology has changed a little bit. From, I guess, like the past 5 to 10 years, maybe even sooner. Some of mine are like kind of new, but you don't need them anymore because there's even newer things.
Yeah.
What a life. What a time what a to life. Be alive.
What a time to be alive.
But before we get into it, we have two sponsors today, and they are Datadog and Sentry. So let's start with Datadog. Datadog is a software as a service-based monitoring platform that provides dev and ops teams with a unified view of all their systems, apps, and services. You'll be a part of thousands of organizations who already rely on Datadog to collect, visualize, and alert them of abnormalities. There are over 200 turnkey integrations, including AWS, Postgres, Kubernetes, and Slack, all done out of the box with customized metrics to gain full stack observability with a unified view of all of your systems, apps, and services. Other key features include real-time visibility from customizable dashboards, algorithmic alerts like anomaly detection, outlier detection, forecasting alerts, end-to-end tracing to visualize application performance, and real-time collaboration. Datadog is offering listeners a free trial, and as an added bonus to that free trial for signing up, you get a free t-shirt. So start a free trial today at datadog.com/toolsday. That's datadog.com/toolsday. And get your free dashboard and free t-shirt. Again, that's datadog.com/toolsday.
Good times. All right.
Mr. Chris.
Okay. Do I go first?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So let's bring it back. This one is a gimme almost. I built my first website, I think, in either 2000-ish, probably 2000. And I was at 10 or 11, and, you know, I was really into Pokemon. And I really wanted to show a little Pokemon gallery. Just I should show a bunch of photos of Pokemon, which I thought was going to be super cool. And the tool you used at the time was something we all know. Not we all. This is kind of aging myself, maybe. FrontPage. Okay, so this is my first Pour One Out for FrontPage. It got me into web development. It was, this editor. Not really editor. It was a GUI that you could click and drag, and you could build your own website with. It made, you know, table layouts as it were wanted to do, and you could, you know, drag in counters, you can drag in all these interactive elements like carousels and whatnot, and build yourself a fully functioning advanced. Well, so carousels, some of the more advanced features required something called front page extensions, which your web host had to provide. It was something that had to be installed on your web hoster's platform, and so not all web hosting services had front page extensions installed, and so you'd have to look for that specific kind of host. But it was the time on the web where, like, you have all this, you know, you think of the Space Jam website and all those kind of 90s websites. So many of them are kind of built in front page, and so definitely formative for me. Thank you next for front page.
Thank you next. It's like very trendy right now. Thank you next, Marie Kondo's like whole system of thinking your items and throwing them out.
Oh man,
I actually never learned front page. I think I'm a little bit younger than you, but I did make a lot of websites on Flash. That was what got me into web development. I made a couple of Flash websites, and then Dreamweaver. But when I was learning how to like formally build websites in college, my professor didn't really know how to use Dreamweaver. He just kind of used it as like a text editor, which I think was amazing because we actually had to learn how to code things by hand. Like, I never learned how to use any of the buttons in Dreamweaver, just like used it as like a basis. But like, kind of speaking back to that time, the first thing that I wanted to bring up was CyberDuck.
Still around.
CyberDuck is still around. I mean, a lot of these tools are still around. I just don't use it anymore. Basically, it let you FTP into a server and like physically drag and drop your files and like see how they all moved over, which created a really convoluted process if you're working with more than one person. You know, you didn't know when people had recently updated. Anyway, it was a mess. So, I mean, we have a lot better tools now. We have like continuous integration. We have a lot of tools that automatically like push to servers and run testing for you and can run scripting. But CyberDuck was such a great tool to use back in the day. It was like my favorite little FTP tool. And I learned a lot about how servers work through it.
Yeah, so I remember when I swapped when I swapped to Mac OS in 2008, CyberDuck was kind of the FTP client of choice because it looked like a Mac application.
It did. It behaved a lot better than a lot of the Windows applications. But I actually didn't swap to a Mac OS until maybe 2012.
Am I just old now?
No, I mean, I was really late to the Mac game because my dad would... So my laptops all growing up were from my dad buying broken laptops on eBay, fixing them and then giving them to me and my brother as like our laptops. And so he knew how to build Dells. Like, he knew how to build those out. So that's what we got.
Fair enough. My next one is kind of along the same vein. It's TextMate. And so those of you who follow the show for a while know that I think like 2 years ago, I was swapping editors every 2 months. I was like,
"Oh yeah, that was a good
for
time."
A new editor, TextMate was really what kicked this all off for me back in the day. So when I swapped to Mac, I was like, "Oh, I need a code editor." And on Windows and across platforms, there was of course Dreamweaver, but at a certain point in time, everyone was like, stop using Dreamweaver, it's not cool. And I was like, okay, I don't want to be not cool, and so I'll swap too. And so I swapped off a Dreamweaver, and TextMate was kind of this revelation. It was on a Mac. It looked like a Mac application. It allowed you to have themes and like user preferences and split screen editing and all these kind of things we associate with modern code editors like VS Code and Atom. A lot of them originated on TextMate, and
it's also still around, isn't it?
Still around, but not really a thing. Most people from TextMate migrated to Sublime Text, to the point where Sublime Text actually reads TextMate bundles because that was kind of its first core thing. And you have all these things that are ported from TextMate to Sublime. Now you have Sublime ported to VS Code. And, the progression of code editors. But, if you go back in the day and look at some of these snapshots of text editors on Mac around when TextMate came out, or the TextMate 2, really, you have these super Windows-y Visual Studio-looking like applications, which have, the rectangular bars, it has the Windows GUIs, and then you look at TextMate 2, it's this Mac aesthetic. It looks and works so cleanly. It was really cool. So, shout out to them for kickstarting off the code editors wars. So now we have such great stuff. So,
oh, I like that. All right, so my next tool is Firebug, something that a lot of developers knew, loved, used to learn about web development. It was basically like the early inspect element, and it allowed for you to literally just inspect element. And it was on Firefox is how it started, like an extension. And it was amazing. And that's definitely what helped me to learn a lot about web development. I would just, Firebug inspect everything and then see how they were building things, like how gradients were happening. And like, it was just such a good tool and it became an integrated part of the browser. So pour one out for Firebug.
Oh yeah, man. Firebug was so crucial for me, especially when you were doing like, at one point, you could install Firebug onto Internet Explorer. Like, there's a little extension thing you could do, or a little script you could do.
Yeah, you were able to port it onto Chrome. Like, you were able to port it everywhere.
Yeah, and it was just so good.
And recently we had Adam Argyle on the show who created something called VizBug, which lets you to visually change web pages. And it was inspired by Firebug, where you could like see how the whole layout of your page looks inside of this tool and just physically click and like change styles. So that was a really good show. If you're interested in that app, it's called VizBug. I think it was 3 shows ago. So check it out in our archives.
Yeah. Yep. My next tool, was another one of these Kickstarters for me. It's Grunt. My Grunt is not that old.
Oh, yes. Wow. What a time.
It's not that old, and many people still use it with great success.
I still use it for, Reveal.js because that's what it's built in.
Yes. And so this is still a poor one up for me because... please, come on, stop using Grunt. No, it's not under active development anymore. So, but anyways, I first heard about Grunt when I went to a jQuery conference in 2012. It turned to be an overall JavaScript conference in general. And it was like, wow, I didn't know you could do all these crazy things like concatenate files automatically and minify these things and automate all these tasks. So those of you who don't know, Grunt came before Gulp, came before Webpack and all this stuff, and it's a task automation software. It lets you program up some tasks and run them when you run a command.
Like minimizing images, like concatenating your files together, minifying those files, those sorts of things.
Yep. And Grunt's main thing was that, versus Gulp, which came out after, is that it was all about configuration. So you wouldn't write a ton of JavaScript code to actually run Gulp tasks. Generally, you'd be configuring plugins and doing specific things that other people had already done. And then you'd hit the go button and it would go. When Gulp came around, their big shtick was that, hey, it's just JavaScript code. Write your JS code and we'll, you know, automate your tasks for you. In the beginning, many people use it just like Grunt, where you'd have a bunch of plugins and go from there. And even now, you still do the kind of the same way. But Gulp enabled you to do more. But Grunt really was the forerunner for this. We actually had our very first show was on Grunt versus Gulp.
That's so funny. I want to listen to it now. I mean, we've been doing this podcast for 3 years. I am very curious to hear my professional opinions from 3 years ago.
Yes, our very first show was Task Runners on Grunt, Gulp, Broccoli, Brunch, Mimosa.
Oh my god. Yeah, I've never actually used Brunch or Mimosa. We just talked about it. I like researched for the show.
Yeah.
But I'm very familiar with Grunt and Gulp, and I've done a lot of coding to prepare my dev environments with them.
Yes.
For some reason, this isn't on my list, but it kind of reminds me of Yeoman. Because like that time in my life, I was using Yeoman generators when I was using Grunt.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is also sort of a poor one out because I don't really know that much use for it.
I don't think people use Yeoman. I mean, I'm sure some.
Yeoman was basically a file generator where you would create Yeoman generators and you would have people sort of pull them down and build out files with options. Yeah. So it would kind of be a CLI tool for templates like. Skeleton files for different types of websites. It was really free form. But I feel like now people just use like create React app or whatever CLI tool is built in with the tool that they're using, like the framework they're using.
I used Yeoman a ton when I was doing like the mean stack, Mongo Express, Angular, Node. They had a Yo mean generator. And it would scaffold out the entire project for you. And, you know, doing a mean stack project required a lot of boilerplate, and so it was a huge time saver, and like it was super nice because it standardized what projects should look like for a lot of people, since a lot of us at the time were using Yeoman and these yo command.
Yeah, it was a really great tool. I mean, it still is a great tool. I wonder why we don't really use it anymore. I mean, I just said why I think we don't use it anymore, but it's still very applicable to any variety of projects. Is basically just like a configurable convention tool where somebody created like a layout and you can customize it.
I just pulled up Yeoman's website and I went to a couple of tools and they haven't been updated since like 2016, so probably not a well,
that's probably why.
Actually, anyways, well, okay, I just found an IBM.
I have so many more now because I just added to my list. I'm going to go again with another one.
Okay.
So this is probably what got me really into programming the most, and that's Ruby SAS. So, of course, I have to mention Ruby SAS. Ruby SAS was the original way to write SAS, and it was actually written in a Ruby syntax, so there wasn't, like, SAS evolved, but originally SAS didn't have, like, the semicolons and the CSS, like, syntax that it does now. I love that version of SAS even more. I love how Ruby SAS was so extensible. I was learning Ruby at the time of my internship, so it definitely went hand in hand for me, and it was such a great developing community. I think 2013 was the first SAS conf, and like I think SAS started in 2007 originally. Like, it's been going on for a while, but people don't really use Ruby SAS anymore because it is pretty slow to build. And so now people use Node SAS, which is a port of Ruby SAS. It's a lot faster. Well, not really a port. They wrote SAS in C, and then they used that C to port it out to Node. And now you have a lot of it's like Dart SAS like, is a thing.
Yeah, now they're like, maybe we should swap to Dart SAS. And then I actually have SAS as one of my poor one outs just in general as a whole.
Oh, I still use it.
I
feel like a lot of people use it. I mean,
I know.
Carbon used it.
This is a personal poor one out.
Okay.
My other ones were like, oh yeah, I think we've all moved on rather.
I think that with SAS, I don't use it as much in new personal projects. I will use CSS modules. It still is very valid.
It's still useful, kind of. Well, okay. So I think for basically every one of my SAS use cases, I don't need them anymore.
I kind of agree with you. There's different ways, like CSS variables.
Yeah. All right. So my browser matrix, when I do new projects, generally, if it's my own project or if it's at work, we do internal tools, so it's Chrome only. For my apps I'm building for my own projects, it'll be evergreen browsers, right? And so CSS variables are all there. So I'm not going to use SAS variables. And SAS variables are, while they're less code to type than CSS variables, are much weaker than CSS variables since they're compile time. SAS variables are compile time. And then the other main thing I liked from SAS are mixins, functions, and nesting of SAS, nesting of styling, specifically with the state nestings like ampersand, hover, ampersand, focus. And the nesting you can get really easily with post CSS. It's a small plugin. And then the mixins and functions, I just don't use as much anymore. And when I do use them, I'm actually writing CSS and JavaScript most of the time now. And so they're just JavaScript functions now, which produce something. And there are a couple of really cool. And so, yeah, it's just one of those things where.
But if you weren't using a JavaScript framework.
I would probably use CSS modules. And I would probably be okay not having mixins and functions. And just have a class that does it, like a CSS class that does it for me.
Well, it depends, because if you don't have a lot of things to dynamically write out, then it's fine. Which you don't usually, but it could.
You don't usually, like, for most, like, of my, like, you know, like, because I generally build applications versus like generative art or like art projects, and so with applications it's more like, how do we do layout really well? And so
that's where like all those HTML generators were great too.
Yeah,
because you could say like 100 times div, that's going to be one triangle inside of like a 3D crazy object that expands and contracts.
Yeah, but in an application you don't need that kind of power. You just need well, the newest CSS specs, like, now that I have VH, now that I have CSS grid, I have all these great newer CSS layout stuff. I don't need the stuff that SAS would give me. And so
I can't believe we've gotten here.
I know.
But I've recently had these conversations also like outside this podcast where I'm like, I don't really find myself needing it, but a lot of companies and people still highly maintain it and start new projects with it.
I think people reach for it almost by default, but I do think people should start, you know, rethinking, do I actually need this?
Well, I mean, tool. Then they'll have to reach for something else, like CSS modules, like we were talking about, you know?
Yeah.
Although that kind of solves a different set of problems anyway.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, a slight different set of problems. The whole global versus local code, but even just like plain CSS and just concatenating the files together. When you use SAS, you're always introducing one. When you use any kind of compile tool, you're introducing one layer of complexity to your code and to people joining it. And so, if someone else doesn't know SAS, then you have to learn SAS, and so.
And you have to create a development environment that supports it.
All right. Still love you, SAS, but not in like
as much.
It's like we had some times.
I love SAS forever, but I just don't love it as much anymore. That kind of reminds me of this other tool that I wasn't sure if I'd mention, but Penthouse, if you remember. Penthouse was a CSS minifier for critical CSS that you'd put in the head of your document. So that was like a performance best practice when you were using CSS files that sent the entire CSS of the website, like we used to do, or at least that page, then you would put the critical CSS in the head so that anything that appeared above the fold would get the CSS, and then the rest of the CSS would load in afterwards. It was like an optimization.
I've heard of Adios Money's critical path. I've never heard of Penthouse before.
So Penthouse was like a tool that did it for you. But it was among the same vein.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not even that old. I think it's like a 2015, maybe. Probably 2015-ish time.
I'm going through the releases right now. 2015 is...
Oh, nice. Okay. I got that right. Timeline. So I find that this is a very interesting tool and that like thought in a specific direction that was something that we do now, but now we have dynamic imports and we have code splitting, so we don't really need to separate things based on like the size of a viewport at a specific time.
I mean, and like a lot of this, if you use CSS and JS, a lot of them do it for you already. So
right, exactly.
Like, it's just built in.
So that's like one auto magical thing, kind of like live reload. That's another thing that I wanted to mention, where you used to have to download a browser plugin.
Oh yeah.
And then have that be activated on your browser, then also go into like the file path inside that project directory and link them and then run that server. So it was linking and live reloading. And it wasn't even that automatic. It like took like a second to live reload anyway. And now we have like auto magical, like true live reloading, like just built into Webpack.
I remember actually when scaffolded my first major grunt project. Speaking of grunt, my first job, I also included live reload, and it just blew everybody's mind. It was like, oh my god,
because it was magic. It was so cool. You didn't have to go and refresh the page. It was unbelievable at the time, and now it's like we just expect that.
Yeah, it's just of course. If you don't have live reload in your project, what kind of schmooze are you? Lots of people probably don't have it, but it's if you don't, you should. Okay, so my last poor one out is also not super old. It's Browserify or Browserify. People pronounced it so many different ways. And I think this was actually the topic of like our second show.
Did you just go through old shows?
No, I just think about it right now on the fly. Actually, so I'm looking it up right now. yes, module loaders, 2015, October 26th. We talked about AMD, CommonJS, Browserify, and Webpack.
Wow.
And back in the day, it was a big little... Well, Browserify was the first one. It was by a guy named Substack, who has a real name as well, which I can't remember. I actually just saw him speak at JSConf Hawaii. He's going over a really cool project with geomapping in the Amazon forest. But anyways, he invented this thing called Browserify. It'll allow you to... essentially write common or AMD or CommonJS modules, and these were two different module syntaxes back in the day. CommonJS is still used for Node all the time now, although now we have ES6 modules, and AMD modules are kind of dead. But and it would let you build a hierarchical tree of your code with requires, and so you'd have, you know, what we all know and use today is with Webpack, have a, you know, a... We would not have dependency management issues like we used to. We used to have to, you know, order our script tags in a specific way before we concatenated them to make sure nothing was loaded in the wrong order. And it would suck if you got one out of the order, because then nothing would work and you'd crash and you'd be so sad. And yeah, and so Webpack changed all that. And then Webpack came around with a much better interface and we all swapped. But yeah, it was the first of the bunch and it was super useful. So RIP Browserify.
I don't even remember using it that much. So
I think if you
like a big RIP to me.
Yeah, if you weren't, a lot of people went straight from concatenating builds to Webpack. There was like about a year or ish in like 2015, 2014, maybe 2014, 2016, where people were like, what do I use, Webpack or Browserify?
And right, I do remember that, but I just picked Webpack and that ended up being the thing that stuck.
Yeah, and Browserify was really into like, oh, we got to support AMD modules. And Webpack was like, let's just do CommonJS, more or less. And that's made a lot more sense for a lot of people. It had a lot less overhead. And now we have the Webpack versus Rollup stuff. So, you know,
yeah,
never really goes away.
So the last thing that I want to talk about is very far from all of that. and it's called CSS Zen Garden.
Oh,
and so, yeah, right? So CSS Zen Garden was an, I guess, early sort of educational tool that basically was a website. And it encouraged you to download the CSS and HTML file and then restyle it to showcase the power of CSS. And they actually recently brought it back. So there's like a couple of new designs by like Trent Walton and Dan Mall and Andrew Lohman. So there's like new designs now. But it basically was like a project that sat quiet for a long, long, long time. And you just had these people submit the same website but styled completely differently by changing the CSS to showcase the power of CSS 3, which was new at the time. And there's some really cool creative visuals here. I mean, like a lot of them you had to hack around. So it's just interesting to see how these kind of turned out. And a lot of them are like pretty narrow screen sizes, because that was sort of a thing back in the day. Like literally this site that I'm looking at, you have the full browser and maybe 70% of it is white space, because I think originally that would be just like the 960 browser, the 960 grid.
Oh God. Oh my God. I just saw, speaking of grids, I just saw some Facebook posts for myself from like 2010 about just figure out the 960 grid system. I feel like a genius or something. I'm like, oh my God.
So funny. Yeah, I mean, CSS Zen Garden was such an inspiring tool for a lot of people. I feel like it was taught in schools. It was a great tool for like kind of getting people excited about CSS. So that's sort of my last. Sorry, while you were talking about Browserify, I was kind of looking through the CSS Zen Gardens, and so I got kind of distracted. I was like, oh, there's
okay.
So many.
As you were talking about Zen Gardens, I am looking through Zen Gardens right now. So it's...
So while you look through Zen Gardens, I want to thank our second sponsor today, and that is Sentry.io. Their motto is, your code is broken, let's fix it together, which is nice because I feel like that's a sentiment I really can relate to. Relying on customers to report errors, essentially treating them as an offsite QA team, is not good. It's rude to customers and bad for business. Ideally, this would be solved with tests. Why not cover every scenario with a test? Then life would be perfect and fine and great. Because here in reality, humans are pretty bad at writing tests. Not just because we're all kind of lazy, but also because we can't anticipate every single way our users are going to interact with our product. They might do something really, really bizarre or really, really smart that we haven't even thought about. That's why Sentry tells you about your errors in your code before your customers have a chance to encounter them. Not only do they tell you about those errors, but they also give you all the details you'll need to be able to fix them. You'll see exactly how many users have been impacted by a bug, the stack trace, the commit that error was released as a part of, the engineer who wrote that line of code, and a lot more. So check out sentry.io and get your code fixed today. That's sentry.io. Okay, Chris, do you have any last comments, memories?
I'm all out of memories. No, this has been a fun show.
No, there's a lot of tools that we didn't mention that I'm sure that we'll like kind of think about over the next day. Like, oh, we should talk about that in the show.
Yeah.
I want to thank you all for sort of listening to our show this week, and thank you again to our sponsors, Sentry and Datadog. Remember to check out sentry.io for all your test coverage needs, and then also your free dashboard and t-shirt at datadog.com/toolsday. Also, shout out to our patron Webflow. They're doing some really cool things, so check them out as well. If you learned something on this podcast or just enjoyed our banter, we'd actually love to hear from you. So if you have a favorite tool that you want to pour one out for, send us a tweet or come chat with us in our Spectrum chat. Also, share this podcast with a friend, because that's how people discover the show. If you're feeling love, it's around Valentine's Day season. If you want to share your love with us, please leave a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to this podcast, and that'll also help other people discover the show. That's all we have for this week, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.